Pull up a chair. I want to tell you about an airplane that set a speed record on the way to its own retirement party. Flew faster than almost anything ever built, coast to coast, and at the end of that flight it didn't land to be washed and hangered and flown again next week. It landed to be bolted to a floor and stared at. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Tail Dragger, and you're listening to The Hangar, and today we're standing under a blackbird. Now, before I get rolling, let me tip my hat to today's sponsor, because they get it. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. And friend, the airplane I'm about to describe, that's a story worth carrying in your pocket. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. All right, let's go back to March 6th, 1990. The airplane is a Lockheed SR-71, the reconnaissance bird everybody just called the Blackbird. This particular one wears the tail number 61-7972. The crews called her 972. She's painted a black so deep it looks like a hole cut in the sky, and that paint isn't for looks. It sheds heat, because this airplane gets hot. We'll get to that. By 1990, the Air Force is shutting the whole program down. Budgets, satellites, politics. The details don't matter as much as the fact. The fastest, highest-flying air-breathing airplane the world had ever seen was being sent home, and somebody with a little poetry in their soul, decided that 972 shouldn't just be trucked to a museum on a flatbed. She should fly there. And if she was going to fly there, well, she might as well set a few records on the way. Now, here's where it gets interesting. The crew that morning was Lieutenant Colonel Ed Yielding up front and Lieutenant Colonel Joseph Vita in the back seat. In the Blackbird, the front seater flies the airplane. The back seater, the reconnaissance systems officer, runs the navigation and the sensors, and on this particular day, the stopwatch that history was going to read. Joe Vita, by the way, had more hours in the SR-71 than any human being alive. If you were going to pick two men to fly the last one across the country, you picked those two. The plan was simple to say and hard to do. Take off from the West Coast. Get out over the Pacific. Hit the tankers, top off every drop, because this airplane drinks fuel like nothing you've ever seen. Then turn around. Line up on the California coastline and light the fires. They would cross the entire United States, and the clock would start when they crossed the coast near Los Angeles and stop when they crossed the coast near the Chesapeake at Salisbury, Maryland, from one edge of the country to the other. Let me paint you the cockpit, because this is the part people never talk about. You do not climb into a Blackbird in a flight suit and a ball cap. You put on a full pressure suit, a spacesuit, silver or gold visored, the whole business, because you're going up above 80,000 feet, and up there the air is so thin that if your cabin let go, your blood would boil before you could say a prayer. So you're sealed in a suit, breathing bottled oxygen, and it takes a team of people just to get you strapped in. The airplane smells like jet fuel, but a strange fuel, a special blend called JP7, that's so stable you could put out a cigarette in it. They had to inject a chemical just to get the engines to light. And here's the thing that gets every mechanic who ever worked her, on the ground. Cold, 972 leaks. Fuel weeps right out of the seams of the fuselage and puddles on the ramp. That's not a defect. That's the design. Because when this airplane flies fast, the friction of the air heats the skin to hundreds of degrees. The metal expands. Those panels that gap and leak on the ground swell up tight and seal themselves in flight. Lockheed built an airplane that only stops leaking once it's going three times the speed of sound. Kelly Johnson and his Skunk Works crew out in Burbank, they built the thing back in the early 1960s with slide rules and cigarettes and sheer nerve, and it is still, all these decades later, a machine that makes your jaw drop. Now, the run. They come off the tanker over the Pacific, heavy with fuel, and they turn east. Ed Yielding pushes the throttles up, and the two Pratt and Whitney J-58s come alive. These aren't normal jet engines. At high speed, they turn into something closer to ramjets, gulping the air and shoving it through, and the airplane accelerates in a way that presses you back into the seat and just keeps pressing. They cross the California coast, and Joe Vita starts the clock. Think about what's happening below them. Somewhere down there is a fellow in a Cessna 172 bumping along at 110 knots, worried about the headwind. Somewhere down there is an airliner at flight level 330, cruising along at 8/10 the speed of sound, feeling pretty quick. And 17 miles overhead, 972 is going more than three times the speed of sound, better than 2,000 miles an hour. So fast that the sky above her isn't blue anymore, it's black. And you can see the curve of the Earth bending away at the edges of the windscreen. At that speed, the continental United States is not a journey, it's a glance. They crossed from the coast of California to the coast of Maryland, the whole country. And the clock, when Joe Vida stopped it, read 64 minutes and change. 64 minutes, Los Angeles to Washington. Let that settle for a second. Back when the pioneers I love to talk about crossed this country, it took Cal Rogers 49 days in the Vin Fizz, wrecking the airplane over and over. It took the wagon trains half a year. A modern airliner needs the better part of 5 hours, and 972 did it in the time it takes you to eat lunch. Along the way, she set 4 separate speed records that day, recognized officially, timed over measured segments, Los Angeles to Washington, Kansas City to Washington, St. Louis to Cincinnati, a leg she covered. So fast the record works out to well over 2,000 miles an hour. These weren't estimates, these were surveyed, timed, and certified by the people whose job it is to hold the stopwatch on history. And here's the detail I love the most. As they came screaming up the eastern seaboard and got near Washington, they had to slow down, they had to come out of the record run. Throttle back from 3 times the speed of sound, drop down out of the flight levels, put the gear down, and enter the traffic pattern at Washington Dulles International Airport like a visitor, like a guest. The tower cleared her to land. And Ed Yalding brought that black airplane, still warm, still ticking as the metal cooled and contracted and the seams began to weep fuel onto the runway again, down onto the pavement at Dulles. It was the last flight that airframe would ever make. They rolled out, they shut her down, and a crowd was waiting, because she wasn't taxiing to a squadron. She was being handed, right there, on the ramp, to the Smithsonian Institution, the National Air and Space Museum. From the cockpit to the collection in one afternoon, now that's a hard moment, if you think about it like a pilot. Most airplanes die badly. They get scrapped, they get parted out, they rot behind a hangar with weeds growing through the wheel wells. It's an ugly thing to watch a great machine come to nothing. But 972, she went out at the very top, she flew the fastest coast-to-coast flight in history, and then she landed and became immortal. There's a grace in that most of us don't get. For years, she sat at the Smithsonian's facility while they built her a proper home. And today, if you drive out to the Stephen F. Udvar Hazy Center out by Dulles in Virginia, you can walk in, and there she is, front and center in the aviation hangar, that impossibly long black shape, the twin tails, the engine nacelles that look like they belong on a spaceship, the whole airplane leaning forward like it's still in a hurry, even standing still. Go stand under the nose of her sometime. Get up close. Look at the skin. It isn't smooth and shiny like a show plane. It's got a texture to it, a ripple, because most of that airframe is titanium. And titanium was so hard to work with in 1962 that Lockheed practically had to invent the tooling to build the thing. And here's a story that'll curl your toes. A good deal of the raw titanium for the Blackbird program was bought quietly through shell companies from the Soviet Union. The very country the airplane was built to fly over and photograph. They spied on the folks who sold them the metal to build the spy plane. You can't make that up. Stand there long enough and you'll notice the fuel stains under her. Even now, even cold and quiet in a climate-controlled museum, a Blackbird tends to weep just a little because that's who she is. She was built to be fast, not tidy. I've stood under that airplane. And I'll tell you what goes through your mind. It isn't the numbers, even though the numbers are absurd. It's the people. It's Kelly Johnson and a crew of engineers solving problems nobody had ever solved, with no computers to speak of, because their country asked them to. It's the pilots who zipped themselves into those pressure suits and rode a leaking, howling, red-hot dart to the edge of space over hostile territory, alone, with nothing but their own hands, and Joe Vida's navigation to bring them home. It's a whole way of doing things. A way that says, if we're going to do this, we're going to do it better than anyone thought was possible. And on the 6th of March, 1990, 2 men took the last one of those airplanes and, instead of quietly ferrying it to a museum, they used the trip to remind the whole country exactly what it had built. They didn't sneak her into retirement. They flew her across America faster than she'd ever been flown, set the record books on fire, and parked her in front of the world. That's not a delivery flight. That's a farewell salute at 2,000 miles an hour. The details of that final flight, the crew names, the record times, those come straight from the National Air and Space Museum's own account and from Lockheed's history of the program. And if you're ever near Dulles, the folks at the Udvar Hazy Center will point you right to her. So next time somebody tells you they don't build them like they used to, you tell them about 972. Go see her. Stand under that black nose and look up. And mind the puddle. She still leaks. I'm Tail Dragger. You've been listening to The Hangar right here on Radio Hangar. More stories waiting for you over at RadioHangar.com. Keep the blue side up, and I'll see you next time.